Hi, my name is Joyce. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 24th, 2005. Valerie D. from Richmond is my sponsor, and I'm from the Midtown Group. We meet on Sunday nights in Bethesda, Maryland. If you're ever in the area, please come and visit. And thank you so much to Billy for asking me to come out and share. I mean, I feel truly honored to be on this panel. You know, I mean, these are great speakers, and I mean, there are some of my heroes are in this room right now, so I'm a little self-centered and nervous. And thank you, Merv, for an amazing talk, a tough act to follow. And you know, I want to apologize in advance. This weekend is an annual event my home group puts on. We do this little conference about an hour south from here, so I'm going to have to miss Dwayne. Even I love hearing him talk, and so if you don't see me, that's why I didn't go run off into the woods. But, you know, the thing that I was thinking about was a couple things. You know, I mean, Merv and Dwayne are two men that I've had the privilege of hearing before, and not just hearing, because I know that they're great, you know, speakers, but more importantly, I've seen them. You know, we see each other at conferences, and we're seekers, you know, and I've seen Dwayne in his home group doing service and people that he sponsors. And because if you're anything like me, I mean, I've always been a talker. You know, I know how to talk the talk and look the look, but when nobody's looking, how am I living? You know, and that's the amazing thing is that I know that these two men, and hopefully I can speak for myself, is that I try to live this, you know, and my sponsor impresses that on me all the time, that AA is not a place, but it's a way of life, you know, and I definitely try to live it. So I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and how I try to live today. And, you know, it's funny, I was driving over here from the campgrounds that we're at, and it's a beautiful drive, and I'm a Jersey girl. You know, I was born and raised in New Jersey, and I was just thinking, I was like, God, I mean, AA, I mean, God and Alcoholics Anonymous has definitely brought me to places I would have never been, you know, because I could tell you this, I had never seen anything as beautiful as this place. So, you know, and that's where I was raised. I was born in Jersey, and I came from a family of drunks and heavy drinkers. And that's not what makes me alcoholic, but, you know, the only reason why I mentioned that is because I had a lot of access to alcohol, you know, and I really related to Merv. I mean, before I started drinking, I mean, I was plagued with self-centeredness and, you know, what the book describes as that spiritual malady before I ever picked up that drink. And I would have never been able to describe that to you. You know, all I know is that from my earliest memories is that I felt disconnected. I was terrified. You know, I never felt a part of, not even my own family. And I don't know what that is. And I don't think that's something unique to alcoholics. But what I do know is that when I took my first, when I had my first drunk at 10 years old, it washed that all away, you know. And I relate to Bill Wilson when he talks about discovering alcohol and that feeling that I had arrived. Because that's exactly what it felt like. You know, I don't know what a 10-year-old has to be stressed out about, you know, anxious about. But I was, you know, and it's Johnny who said, I mean, Clancy says, or no, it is Johnny who says that, you know, I mean, alcohol saved my life. You know, it was intolerable to me living in my own skin. And when I had, you know, several glasses of Johnny Walker Black Label, I mean, it lit me up. You know, it's like someone turned on the lights. And that is the effect produced by alcohol that I chased. You know, that is the effect produced by alcohol that is unique to people like us and a normal person will never be able to comprehend. Yeah, it may make them feel good. It may make them feel giddy. They may lose their, you know, inhibitions. It may be a social lubricant. But for me, it was life-changing. You know, I mean, it changed my perception of who I was and the world around me. And you could look at photographs of me. I mean, I became a different person. And my ego, I mean, just grew and grew and grew the more I drank, you know. And I went through several phases. I mean, the first couple years of my drinking, it was so much fun. You know, I'm not here to bash alcohol. I absolutely loved it. It was a great time. I, you know, constant parties and, you know, glorious stories Monday morning. You know, I built this reputation as being a party girl. And, you know, I could drink a lot. I had a high tolerance. And I was wild and I loved it. You know, I loved everything about it. But, you know, like Merv mentioned, I mean, my illness is progressive. And soon thereafter, like, you know, it says in the big book that women are beyond recall after a short time. And I was beyond recall, you know, within 2 years. Within 2 years, you know, I had my first intervention. You know, the chairs were circled up. I was cornered by, you know, counselors, substance abuse counselor, friends, and, you know, people asking me what's wrong with me. And I had no idea what they were talking about. You know, I remember catching, you know, I knew that I had at some point crossed that line, you know, and diverged into a different direction because I wasn't drinking to have fun or for social purposes, you know. I wasn't, I had social intentions maybe my first time I wanted to get drunk, but after that, I mean, I drank for effect. And that was, if you're normal, that looks very different to what other people are doing. You know, because they're like sharing and sipping, you know, and I'm bringing like grain alcohol, taking it to the face, you know, hiding in the woods, hoarding drinks because I'm afraid of running out. You know, I mean, just like red flags everywhere, you know, not normal. And I didn't understand that. No one had that fear of running out. You know, when people were passing that bottle around, I mean, I was like measuring out how much I was going to get, you know, and that fear of running out, I mean, plagued me throughout my drinking. And when I had that intervention and people were crying at me and they're telling me how angry they were and scared they were and told pieces of truth and reading off from little pieces of paper, you know, because they were so nervous. I mean, my alcoholic ego, you know, and this is the thing that has separated me and still today can separate me from everyone else. You know, I mean, my ego could not let any of that be received. You know, I mean, it was just like I always had this attitude like, you don't understand. You don't know me. I'm different. You're overreacting. Get off my back. Leave me alone. Stop nagging me. You know, and I, from that point forward, I always had this attitude that if everyone just leave me alone and let me do whatever I wanted to do, I would be fine and everyone would be happy and I would get my way. And that type, you know, they describe that after trying to run the show in 60-63, you know, I mean, that's how I lived. You know, if people just did what I wanted and left me alone, all would be well. Life would be grand. And, you know, but I'm not dumb, and I know that when you're cornered like that, I mean, that's when I began to know how to give this lip service, you know, and I cried, and I apologized, and I went to substance abuse counseling, and went to therapists, and so it started, you know, these countless vain attempts to control and enjoy my drinking. And, you know, from that point forward, for the next 7 years, or, you know, 6 years, I mean, I can't count dozens of times I would get interventions, I would get cornered, I would have to surrender, I would make these sweet promises. And I tried everything, you know, I tried everything that the book prescribed. I mean, taking a trip, not taking a trip, trying to change the amounts that I drank, trying to change the brands, picking up other substances to reinforce my drinking or substitute my drinking, you know. And I became obsessed that if I could find the right combination, you know, if I could find the right formula, then I can get that buzz again. You know, that feeling that Merv was talking about, my first drunk, I just wanted to get back there when I felt that release. And I've heard speakers talk about it. You know, that window gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Shortly thereafter, it's just a memory of what that felt like, that freedom, you know. And yeah, I mean, alcohol gave me relief, but it never gave me that same life-changing experience it. Like, it was a spiritual experience, you know. And it never happened again after that first time when I was 10 years old. You know, I just chased that relief. And, you know, I mean, I ran through groups of people. I relate to what it says in the literature about being a tornado blowing through lives. You know, I mean, I relate to Merv. Like, I absolutely would push people out of my life, you know. And I couldn't see that until I came here. In my inventory, what I saw was people abandoned me. You know, people discarded me. And it's only after I got a little bit of hindsight and got a little sober that I realized I pushed every single person who cared about me away, you know, because it was too hard to be close to me to care, you know, how recklessly I was living. Because, you know, that fun-loving life of the party joys was long gone. You know, for the next, you know, like I said, I mean, after I had that first intervention, I mean, everything went downhill fast because I was like a loose cannon. You know, it was Russian roulette. You had no idea what version of Joyce you were going to get. You know, whether it was going to be hostile and attacking people, trying to fight people, whether I was going to be suicidal, locking myself in a bathroom, saying I'm going to kill myself, whether I'd be on crying jags, whether I'd be fleeting and you'd have to be chasing me down the streets. I'd be getting into vehicles that, you know, just I'd be hitchhiking down the highway, you know, and that's exhausting. You know, I mean, it was exhausting trying to take care of me. And that's, you know, that's another part of my MO, you know, is that I wanted people to take care of me. You know, I was going to be your responsibility. you know, and I was a liability to you. And when you didn't take care of me and you couldn't fix it, then I'd walk away. And then I'd have to recreate myself over. And I went through so many images. You know, I was gangster for a while, and then I was preppy, and then I went to Jesus camp and tried to get saved. You know, I mean, I really tried to fit in anywhere and everywhere, and I couldn't. You know, I mean, I really couldn't. I mean, and this is the thing, too, about the nature of my illness, you know, because I had no idea. You know, I'd sit down in these therapy sessions, substance abuse counseling, and they'd, you know, lay out, you know, these bell curves and give me this information about, you know, my I don't know, glucose and all this stuff, you know. I mean, and it was so much knowledge, you know. And I'm not, you know, I prided myself as being an intellect. I could understand this stuff intellectually, but it had no emotional, you know, weight. You know, it carried, like our book says, I mean, it had no depth and weight. And it was in one ear, out the other. And sometimes, you know, I would have that frothy emotional peel, right? Like when I went to this, like, peace camp, right? I was trying to find inner peace and get centered with myself so I wouldn't live this way. And I went away and, you know, broke down, hit pillows, reenacted my childhood. I mean, you know, some inner child stuff. And I left there feeling like something had changed. You know, feeling a high resolve, feeling like I'll never drink again, you know, feeling that inner peace. But if you're an alcoholic of my type, you know, that frothy emotional appeal, you know, carries a little weight. And eventually, after a week, 2 weeks, you know, the insanity comes back. And that was the more about, you know, I always knew, or I easily identify with the phenomenon of craving that the book talks about. You know, I knew I drank a lot. I knew I was thirsty, always thirsty, you know, to excess. It was apparent to everyone. But the part that was almost undetectable to people, the part that I could not explain to people, was this insanity. You know, when I would return back to drinking after stopping for 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month was the longest I made it on my own, white knuckling it, I couldn't explain to people why I picked up again. You know, it didn't make sense. Because to the outside eye, it looked like all was well. You know, it looked like life is going great. You know, you stopped drinking, you got your family back, you got your friends back, you know, you're employable, you know, you're functioning well, you look healthier, you know. But inside, that spiritual malady starts kicking up. And I get that restless, irritable, discontent. I feel crazy. And I can't explain to people why, you know. And that's the part that, I mean, I thank God that I found alcohol, that, you know, I was brought into Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I heard this message of depth and weight. And they talked about, you know, this threefold illness. And they talked about, you know, and I heard and I could identify with this spiritual malady, you know, because that's the part that was plaguing me. And you know, I mean, I had what Clancy talks about, these, I mean, Tom Flynn talks about these direct hits. You know, these direct hits were these moments of clarity throughout my drinking where it wasn't lip service, where I really wanted to stop. You know, the first one being, you know, I had gotten suspended from school yet one more time. You know, saw my mom, how I was breaking her heart. And my mother was the only person in my whole family who didn't drink, who didn't smoke, who didn't cuss, who didn't hit me. I mean, she was like a saint. And I loved her. If I had the capacity to love anything, it was my mother, you know. And I saw, you know, I saw what I was destroying her. And I promised her yet again after getting suspended from school one more time, you know. I mean, I broke down to her and we had that connection. I felt that moment of clarity. But 2 weeks later, I'm drinking again. You know, 4 months later, she dies of a brain aneurysm suddenly. And I never got the chance to show her, you know, to give her the daughter that she deserves. And, you know, and that was one of the first big hits, you know, that affected my psyche, you know, because that was like the first time that I realized I was out of control. I had no control, you know. And after that, I swore again. I swore on her grave that I was never going to do this again. I was going to be different for the sake of her memory. 2 weeks later, I'm drinking again. You know, and the last 4 years that I was up in Jersey, I mean, it was just me and my drunken father, so we were around the clock, I mean, insanity, you know, drinking around the clock, fighting, you know, one of us was being carried home on any given night, one of us was throwing each other down the stairs any given night, you know, the type of daughter that I am, I'm the type of daughter that leaves him on his back so he can choke in his sleep. You know, I'm the type of daughter that, I mean, he's stricken with grief after my mother's loss, and I'm taking his pills, you know, so I can get a better high off my drunk. And, You know, and I had a couple other direct hits. You know, the first time I experienced real incomprehensible demoralization that the book talks about. You know, I blacked out. I woke up, and a lot of the women in this room maybe identify. You know, I mean, I went to sordid places. You know, I woke up naked, bruised, broken, I mean, demoralized, disgusted with myself, humiliated. And I remember crying in the shower, you know, trying to scrub the filth off me. You know, wishing that I had really blacked out and not remembered the horrific things of the night before, you know, and thinking, you know, this is not the type of woman I want to be. This is not the type of life I want to live, you know, and feeling that high resolve yet again. But 2 weeks later, I can't remember, you know. I lack that, you know, that memory. I mean, just, I mean, it always loses to the insane idea. Always. And my insanity comes in all forms. You know, I relate to the chapter, you know, more about alcoholism and the stories that they tell there, you know, because I would experience these peculiar mental twists, you know, where I would just rationalize it, you know, how this time it was going to be different, or last time someone must have roofied me, or I didn't eat enough, you know, or, you know, even more terrifying, I would experience those mental blank spots where I wouldn't think at all. But I would be around alcohol, and the next thing you know, that stuff's in my mouth, and I no thought process. And I was defenseless, you know, and the only thing I became convinced of after those horrific experiences, after, you know, that incomprehensible demoralization, was that Jersey was the problem. My father was the problem. You know, I was a victim of all these people and all these circumstances, and no one understood, and I couldn't outrun my reputation. So I moved. You know, I moved down to D.C. in an attempt to recreate my life. And I came down to D.C. and within landing into Reagan International, that same day, that same afternoon, I was coming to on some dirty apartment floor, people I didn't know, doing the same things I always do. And I couldn't outrun this, you know. And I had become resigned to the fact that this is the way that I was going to live. You know, I mean, you know, the book talks about delusion. You know, the inability to distinguish the true from the false, that my insane life became the only normal one. And that's what it was. I mean, people would approach me about how I was living or what I was doing, and there was no resonance, you know. It was like, this is, I want to live this way. I'm having a great time. This is awesome, you know. And I was dying on the inside and had no idea. And, you know, the last, you know, I by the time I got into D.C., I mean, anything, you know, I tried to be social. I tried to go clubbing and to bars, and I couldn't. I couldn't do it. I couldn't even pretend. I couldn't even put up the facade that what I was trying to do was a normal living, you know. By the end of my drinking, I just found me and a couple other junkies, a couple other drunks, and we'd lock ourselves up in abandoned apartments, abandoned houses, and just drink to oblivion, because that's what I wanted at the end. I wasn't trying to chase that high anymore or feel that, you know, that get in that window anymore. You know, by the end of my drinking, I wanted oblivion to, you know, put me out of my misery. And my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous was absolutely the grace of God. You know, I was sharing a handle of vodka one night. You know, like I said, I mean, by the end of my drink, it was just me and another person locked up somewhere, so I couldn't get out into the public. And, you know, she locked me up. We locked ourselves up on this rooftop, you know, this rooftop in this apartment building in D.C. And I blacked out. I came to, and I woke up on a couch, fully clothed, tucked in with a blanket, and this girl, you know, woke me up the next morning, and she 12-stepped me. You know, she was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She was 22 years old. She was 2 months sober, and she had found me. You know, and what I experienced that morning is what, you know, like what Merv was talking about. I mean, that when Bill and Bob talked, you know, this language of the heart, this ability to connect with each other in a way that no one else has been able to reach me. And within 15 minutes of this girl telling me how crazy she was, you know, how she loved drinking, I mean, something inside of me surrendered, you know, and I identified that power of identification. You know, for someone like me who's terminally unique, you know, to be able to connect with someone and feel like they understand, I mean, that's unbelievable. You know, and that's what happened, is that within 15 minutes, here's this girl telling me these drunk stories, and I'm laughing and nodding, and then she starts sharing, you know, the spiritual malady part, you know, how her head won't shut up, how her skin never fit, and she was talking, she was saying things that I was never able to articulate, you know, and she had convinced me, you know, to go. She told me she was sober 2 months and asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting. I said yes, and I went around meetings, and I got a big book, I got a sponsor, and I went around. And, I mean, it's unbelievable the ability of my ego to rebuild, you know, because I will be crying, breaking down, telling you the truth, And then that night, I'm like walking in the meeting with my arms crossed, with my head, you know, snubbed high, thinking I'm different, you know, and everything here offended me. You know, the word powerless offended me. The word God offended me. I mean, I was too young. I was too smart. I was too ambitious. I was too everything, you know, and it was so easy to identify out. You know, it took little to no effort. So, you know, after a little time, I just said, you know, this isn't for me, but I'll keep this book. Thank you. And I got it from here, you know. And again, you know, that book sat on my shelf. And again, my last attempt to control and enjoy my drinking. And the last 8 months of my drinking were, I mean, absolute hell. You know, the darkest day of my life, you know. There was nobody else now. It was just me in my bathroom floor, locked in there, you know, strung out, asking God that I not out and not wake up. You know, I was drinking round the clock. I mean, that insanity that Dr. Bob talks about was over me. I was afraid of not being able to fall asleep, and I was afraid of running out of alcohol. I had hidden alcohol everywhere, on my person, in my room. You know, I mean, and by the end of my drinking, I was just drinking grain alcohol, you know, Everclear. And I wanted to die, you know, and like, I love when Bill, you know, reading, you know, Bill's story. I mean, I love the way he describes his bottom, you know, and how he would curse himself as a weakling because he couldn't take his own life, because I would do that all the time. You know, by the end of my drinking, I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. I was so disgusted. And when I would catch a glimpse of myself in the mirror, I would curse myself as a weakling because I couldn't take my own life. I was a coward, you know, and you know, I was like an animal on the side of the road just waiting to die. And I wanted somebody to put me out of my misery. And thankfully, again, you know, the grace of God creeped in. And my last drunk was my father's wedding, you know, this month. You know, and that's why, I mean, in April every year, I always get a little sentimental and reflect, you know, because, I mean, it is, I can't take credit for anything that happened from April 23rd forward. You know, I mean, to this day, I mean, my whole life is a product of Alcoholics Anonymous and the grace of God. And I know that because the best of my ability, the best I could do, you know, got me in fetal position on my bathroom floor. And, you know, my dad was getting remarried. He got this woman pregnant. They were going to have a marriage and they were going to start a family. And I had to show up, you know, because I'd been separated and estranged from my family. So I went up there with all intentions of staying sober, you know, but I got up there and I felt that restless, irritable discontent. You know, and my first drunk and my last drunk, you know, really, I mean, exhibit alcoholism in its fullest, you know, is that I experienced that spiritual malady. I picked up a drink to get that ease and comfort. I experienced the phenomenon of craving. I overshot the mark, you know, and I was a drunken fool. And in the spectrum of my drinking, it wouldn't even have ranked as my worst drunk. But something happened, you know, the next day on April 24th and it's something that I hear speakers talk about all the time. They feel tired. You know, I just felt so tired that I couldn't put up the same game. I couldn't give you the same lip service. I couldn't rationalize and explain yet again the last drunk. You know, so when I came to that next morning to disgusted faces yet again, to crying family members about how humiliated they were, you know, and I remember, I mean, I took a bus ride from New York back to D.C., and family member after family member after family member called me, you know, and they told me truths about myself, how disappointed my mother would have been in me, you know, and how ashamed they were of me. And usually that stuff, I mean, never affected me. You know, I could brush it off, or I could explain what happened, or I could make you feel sorry for me. I mean, I was good at that type of manipulation, but for some reason on that day, I mean, I just listened. And I didn't drink or use that day. And by the 25th, I was going through withdrawal and detox, you know, and I got carried into a clubhouse and I shook and I threw up and I sweated it out, you know, for a week there. And after I, you know, was able to physically detox off all the stuff that I was on, I thought that, I mean, the insane thinking was back already, you know. And again, the grace of God creeps in. You know, because before I could even do anything about that, I had resigned to the fact. I left that clubhouse and went back to where I was staying and was like, I'm glad I'm off that hard stuff. You know, I'm going to drink wine like a lady. And I mean, that quick, you know, it's like, it's amazing how many plans I can come up with, you know. I never try to drink wine like a lady, you know. And that night, you know, that night a girl knocked on my door and she lived down in the floor below me and she said, you know, I heard that you went to AA last year. You know, I had a rough weekend. I need to go to a meeting. Will you take me? And she had no idea what happened. I mean, it's like, and I did. I don't know why, but I took her. You know, I took her to, we caught the last 10 minutes of a candlelight meeting. And And something happened to me there. You know, something happened to me where I walked into the threshold of that church and something broke. And I prided myself as being tough. You know, I prided myself as being someone that didn't cry, you know, that was independent, I was tough, I was self-reliant, you know, I mean, and I walked through the threshold of that church and I broke down. You know, I didn't even hear anything that they were saying, but there was something about the feeling in that room that made it feel safe enough that I broke down and I started bawling, wailing, you know. In my home group, they call me the scream crier because I'm not like a graceful crier. I'm like a shaking, you know, screaming crier. And like you think I'm having a seizure, a crier, you know. So, of course, it was like everyone was looking at us like, oh, they're the newcomers, you know. And they circled up and, you know, two gentlemen from my home group were at that meeting, you know, and they got on their, I don't remember anything they said, no, I don't remember any questions they asked. All they did was get on their phones and start calling women and making plans for me, you know, and I had women pick me up literally for the next 2 weeks, you know, in the afternoon, for the afternoon meeting, in the evening, you know, 4 hours before the meeting started, they'd pick me up and babysit me, and I cried, and I was belligerent, and I was loud, and obnoxious, and so egotistical, you know, and I had no idea what was going on, and I'm so happy that the group is still today so active. I mean, it's easy. You know, they make it easy and almost effortless for you to jump in, you know, and I did, you know, and I watched these women and they would incessantly talk about themselves. You know, I'm like, why are they always talking about themselves and telling me stories? But, you know, they're trying to help me identify, and I did. But I would look at them and their lives were cleaned up, and they were cleaned up, and they took me to their apartments and they were cleaned up, you know, and they talked about these horrific, you know, demoralizing situations from their past, and they felt free from it. And I desperately wanted that. You know, I acted tough and I acted proud, but deep down, I mean, I was terrified and I was ashamed, you know, and I was afraid. And, you know, I got a woman as my sponsor, and within, you know, a couple of weeks, I got offered a job in New York City and I wanted to take it, you know, not, you know, no one thought that was a good idea, and it wasn't, you know, but I was like, oh, I got this job offer and I got to go take it, you know, thanks. You guys have been great. You know, I'll be back in a couple months. And I thought I had it, you know, because I've been going to meetings every day. I got this sponsor by name, you know, and I went up there and I lost my mind. You know, I'm grateful for that experience, though, because although, I mean, I was a lunatic and lost that job and almost killed myself, but I'm grateful for it because I learned so much about the nature of my illness, you know, and I really, you know, I'm going to go through the steps. That's really when my first step started, you know, because I always, you know, I identified with funny stories and could, you know, like I said, I always identified with being a heavy drinker, you know, but when I felt my own skin at 2 months sober, untreated, I mean, I became convinced of what alcoholism really was. You know, when I felt that restless, irritable, and discontent, dead sober, you know, I knew that I was powerless. I knew that my life was unmanageable because I couldn't function without it anymore. You know, and I got so angry at Alcoholics Anonymous because I was up in Jersey, New York. You know, I lived in Jersey, moved in with my father, which was a horrible idea, and because our relationship was still strained and toxic, and I took this job in New York, so I was commuting back and forth, and I went to 3 meetings a day. You know, I hit the morning meeting in New York, went to the lunch meeting in New York, went back to Jersey, went to the night meeting in Jersey, and I was losing my mind. You know, I was the hostile newcomer that, you know, put my hand up, shared for like 20 minutes and then left, you know. I told you all how you were all full of it and this didn't work and I was insane, but like wanted no help, you know. And I know that, and I know in hindsight that my group talked about recovery. They talked about the steps, you know, but the only thing I picked up was go to meetings. And I thought that's what it was. I thought I was going to come to meetings and through osmosis, I was going to be sober, you know, and thank God I got the sponsor that I had for 6 years and this gentleman, I mean, saved my life. And I don't know how or why he was put in my life, but he was, and he saved my life, you know. He started calling me and for some reason his voice is louder than my head and he walked me through the steps fast. Because I needed it, you know. I mean, within working with him, I mean, he was in Maryland still with the home group, and I was in Jersey, and every night, I mean, we would do step work. Every night we talked about the book, and for some reason, it quieted the insanity, you know, and I got introduced to a home group in Jersey that was, I mean, militant AA, you know. I mean, it was, and it was what you know, I think there are different flavors for different people, but it was absolutely what I needed. You know, I needed to be broken in that way. I mean, and they picked me up and they made me go to conferences. I mean, they would pick me up on like a Thursday night and we're in Jersey and I was like, where are we going? There's a meeting down the street. They're like, we're going to Baltimore. I was like, what? Like, why are we going to Baltimore? There's a meeting down the street. And they're like, there's a great speaker down there. You know, and they made me, you know, they took me to the World Convention. They took me into detoxes and commitments and made me tell my story and they got my feet trained. And I'm so grateful that, you know, for early on, you know, it was impressed upon me that this isn't about me anymore, you know, that I had to live a life of service, that the only way that I was going to, you know, get well here was by trying to help others. And it was such a foreign concept. You know, I'd be calling hysterical, like, I want to die. I'm going to kill myself, you know, because I'm very dramatic, so dramatic. And they'd be like, yeah, that's great. Here, pick up this girl, you know, take her to the meeting. I was like, you're not listening to me, you know. And I needed that tough love. You know, my whole life, people felt sorry for me. I mean, I was like, I love pulling that victim card. I could get you crying with me in 10 minutes. You know, professionals, friends, family members, and people in AA, I mean, thank God, I mean, cared more about my life, you know, than my feelings. And they pushed me, and I needed it, you know. And I came to believe, you know. I mean, like I said, I had an aversion towards God because I'd been raised up in church and went to Jesus camp and been saved. And, you know, I could recite stuff from the Bible, and it didn't work. And look at my mother. She was a God-fearing woman. Look at the life she lived with the terrorists like me, you know. And I felt angry. But in taking these actions and calling a sponsor and beginning to read this stuff out of the book, you know, I came to believe in my sponsor. And I came to believe in that group up in Jersey. And I came to believe in the principles in that book. And, you know, and shortly thereafter, I had a God of my own understanding. You know, and I felt okay to pray and talk to it. And, you know, I took that third step prayer in a group of people. That's the way that they did it up in Jersey. You know, they like to do it like old school style. You know, they made me do it out in public. It was so humiliating. And, but I was hungry. You know, I was absolutely hungry for this. And, you know, the great thing too is that, you know, and it's like a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous is that if you chase Alcoholics Anonymous the way that you chase that next drink, I mean, you'll do right fine, you know. And that's what, because I always, when I was drinking, I was a top shelf kind of girl. You know, I want the good stuff. I want to feel good, you know, and that's what people told me, that if I had that attitude in Alcoholics Anonymous and look for the good AA, look for the busy people, look for the winners, and seek that stuff out, then I'll be in good shape, you know. And I did that fourth and fifth step, and I thought that I was this nice girl that drank too much that wasn't angry ever, you know, and here I was, literally wrote down 500 names. Every single person that I had ever come in contact with. You know, I was so petty, and I had, you know, and it was funny because I was like, I'm not resentful at anyone, you know, I get along with everyone. And I put pen to paper, and man, the venom just started coming out, you know, and I thank God, because at that point, I mean, dead sober 2 months, I mean, my head felt like it was trying to kill me. You know, I mean, it would keep me up at night and just rehash and rehash all the things I'd done, all the things people had done to me. And I was able to expel some of that stuff by writing it out, you know, and I wrote it out. I did the best attempt. It was pathetic, but I got it out. And God loved my sponsor for sitting through a day's worth of a fifth step, you know, and I read it. And for the first time, someone knew all of me, you know, which is, had never happened before, because I'm the type of person, I live multiple lives. You know, I'll give you pieces of truth here, pieces of truth there. I'm telling lies over here. I mean, I was so delusional. I had no idea what was true or false. Like I said, I mean, I told so many lies, I started to believe them, you know, and I had so many images, you know, because I'm a performer, right? I look at you, I try to size you up and be whatever version of Joyce you want me to be. And I could still be that, you know, that manipulative today. You know, and for the first time, someone knew all of me. You know, I read this stuff, and I wasn't judged. You know, he didn't even flinch. And, you know, after that experience, I fell asleep that night, you know, for the first time. After that experience, I felt like I had a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. And after that experience, you know, I didn't have a, you know, there's the fifth step promises, and I didn't get those right away. You know, after the fifth step, I felt dirty. You know, I felt like for the first time I saw who Joyce Roldan really was. And it was horrifying, you know. I mean, that fourth column and seeing every single person, I was a taker. You know, I was an absolute taker, and I acted tough, but I was terrified. And I took your sanity, I took your money, I took your drinks, you know, I used you and discarded you. You know, and I didn't want to see that about myself, because I like the victim role. You know, it's much easier. And you know, and I ended up moving back to Maryland, and you know, I started sponsoring people and being involved and getting busy, and I moved back to Maryland, and it was like the next big lesson of my sobriety. You know, how to be one of many, how to be a home group member, because I had no idea. You know, I mean, we were talking about it before the meeting. I mean, my ego was out of control. You know, I mean, I caught fire for Alcoholics Anonymous, but that didn't, I mean, my ego was still out of control, you know, because I was like, I prided myself, you know, and up in Jersey, there wasn't a lot of young people and there wasn't a lot of women. So they called me like the 90-day wonder, you know, and that's like lethal for a newcomer, you know, but I came down to my home group, which at that point was 350 young people who were equally as busy, and I couldn't feel special anymore, you know, and I hated them, and I resented them, and I gossiped about them, and I wanted to move away, and thank God, you know, people right-sized me, you know, that I have enough people, my sponsor, my friends, my trusted confidants, that, I mean, found the chink in my armor, you know, and right-sized me, and taught me how to walk shoulder to shoulder with other alcoholics, taught me how to care about the group more than myself. You know, taught me about the traditions, taught me about love and service. And soon it wasn't their meeting. It was our meeting, you know. And I'm so grateful that, I mean, you know, a big thing about this conference that we do, this camp out that we do this weekend, is that we really focus on the AA triangle, you know, that recovery in the bottom. And I'm grateful that I got a sponsor and I was taken through the steps and I needed that, you know, that I was taught that I have a spiritual malady and I need a spiritual solution that I was only going to get as a result of these steps, you know, and then that the unity, you know, that they took me on these fellowships and they taught me to care for one another. They taught me, I mean, my AA family is like really like my family, you know. I mean, Billy and Lynn have seen me grow up here, literally, you know. And my AA family has taught me how to be a family member. They taught me how to be a daughter. They taught me how to be a woman. They taught me how to dress. You know, they taught me how to be a worker. And I would have never been able to do that had I not had an amazing fellowship, you know. And the other side of that is service, you know, and that to get busy, you know, that I wasn't going to get, I had to earn my way here, that I had to keep this up for the next, you know, class of people is what we call it. And you know, and that if I lived on all three sides of that triangle, you know, that I would feel whole. And I don't live in any perfection of that whatsoever. I mean, I there are times when I just want to go inward and write inventory and seek out and discover myself, you know. And then there are other times when I have just gotten lost in service, you know, and been in every event and gone to 15 meetings a week, you know, and neurotically run from that, you know. There are times I've been fellowship. All I want to do is hang out and have fun. And I know that if any of that is disproportionate, so am I. You know, that I'm uneasy yet again. And, you know, I mean, that, you know, 6 and 7 totally went over my head. You know, I read it out of 12 and 12, and I was like, right, humility. And, you know, just proceeded. And, you know, I think 6 and 7 happened to me. You know, I mean, I said that prayer with all earnest, as much earnestness as I had at the time. But, I mean, it really happened to me because I thought that I got sober, and then I demanded that everybody treat me like I had 20 years sober or something like that. You know, I just wanted to be well already. I wanted to get there. I wanted to be spiritual. And it wasn't like that because I was still so defective. And my defects kicked my butt, you know, for several years and sometimes still do. I mean, you know, the first realization that I had with the 6 and 7 was in the area of my family. You know, when I had a year sober, I was sponsoring 5 people. Like I said, I mean, I felt proud about my recovery. You know, I've been through the steps. I started out in the men's process. And by this point, I had started writing letters to my father. You know, we had to stop talking to each other, but I started writing him letters. I took this direction against my will. And I was like, man, I'm on the path. And then at a year sober, the day after I got a year, my dad sent me a letter and told me that, you know, that my family thought that I should be institutionalized, that they thought that I should be on medication. A year sober. I was like, are you serious? You know? And I was so angry. I was like, and the truth was, is that no wonder they did. Because when I went up and saw my family, the few times that I did, I acted like an insane person. You know, that I could put on my AA face and AA show for the AA meeting. But when no one was looking, I was up with my family. I was a belligerent brat. You know, my emotions were crazy, and I let it all out. You know, my family. You know, I really relate to what Merv said. When I'm off, the people closest to me get it the worst. You know, and I would lash out and take it out, you know, and with that emotional terrorism again. And, you know, and I had to look at this stuff and someone, you know, some and other areas, you know, I realized that I could cheat dead sober, that I could lie dead sober, that I could steal dead sober, you know, and that I wasn't above this. It's not like drinking made me do those things. Drinking made it tolerable for me to do those things. But I was still equally capable of it, you know, in sobriety, and I was, you know, and that horrified me. And I've been brought down to my knees, my ego, you know, I mean, so many different defects. I mean, my ego, like I said, I mean, you know, and sponsoring people and trying to take credit for that or trying to, like use it like a trophy. You know, I mean, I paid high spiritual prices, you know, trying to be in charge, trying to be the boss, trying to look good. You know, and I think, you know, I'm grateful, like Merv said, I mean, sometimes I could feel frustrated, like, gosh, like, why can't I just learn or, like, you know, why can't I just do the right thing? I always have to learn through these awful mistakes and hitting these, slamming into these walls. But I'm grateful for it because it's given me such valuable experience. You know, when people send, you know, their sponsees to talk to me, it's never about the good stuff. Like, they don't want to, like, talk about, like, law school. You know what I mean? They want to talk about how they have physically attacked their boyfriends and how, you know, they want my experience with that. I'm like, all right, you know? They want to talk about, you know, not working at work, they call me. You know what I mean? And I'm grateful. I mean, that's the currency we have here. You know, that sharing my faults, that, you know, my great-grandsponsor used to say that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a showcase for the well. You know, it's a haven, a safe haven for the sick and the suffering. And I try to live like an open book about where I've struggled, you know, because it's definitely what's made me most useful. And, you know, and so I started processing this and started, like, you know, with God's help and accountability and telling on myself, I started to act differently. And like I said, I started doing wrote out my eighth step. And I wanted to balk on that eighth step. You know, no one was letting me do that. You know, they reminded me that Dr. Bob drank again because he didn't want to do these two steps. And I was like, all right, where's that pen and paper, you know? And I went back, you know, I wrote letters to these women that I had terrorized and bullied. You know, because they wouldn't want to see me again. And I started this amends process with my father by sending him a card every 2 weeks, a Hallmark card. And me and my father, I mean, had a violent relationship. So, sending a Hallmark card was beyond me, you know. And, you know, I went back to my mother's grave and made amends. You know, I got direction about what to do. And with all my amends, I went back to my other family members, my cousins, my uncles, my aunts. I made direct amends there. I went back to to send checks to institutions. I sent checks to charities that I stole from, you know, sent checks to places that I, you know, vandalized their property. And I never, you know, I'm still so alcoholic, even in doing the steps, you know, I was always looking for that bang, you know, I'm looking for the white light experience. And I'd be so disappointed every time. You know, I remember driving up with, you know, one of my friends up to my mother's grave and you know, reading this letter, my mother's grave, and I was like, doo-doo-doo, you know, like waiting, you know, where is the white light? And I didn't feel it. And I was so upset, you know, but the amends process for me has always been, you know, that something shifts in me. You know, sort of one of those holes and one of those cracks gets filled in, and I don't even realize it until much, much later. You know, and it's only looking in hindsight that after I made a direct, you know, after I made that amends to my mom's grave, I began to really sponsor the women that I was sponsoring. You know, I really began to feel connected to them in a way that I was unable to before. You know, I was so hostile towards women, you know, because it was my own guilt with my mother. You know, because I had abused her, because I had disrespected her, because I didn't live up to what she deserved. And I would take that out on other women and bully them and feel better than them and put them down. And you know, and I always felt this barrier. But after I made that amends, for some reason, that intimacy, that connection, I began to be able to, I had it. You know, I began to love and care for these women in a way that began to baffle me. You know, where when they would celebrate or pick up a trip, I would cry, you know, and I was like, oh my God, you know, it's like tears of joy, you know, and good things would happen to them and I would get excited. And I know, you know, I know that's a result of the amends with my mom and the amends with these women that I had bullied and beat up. And I heard back from a lot of those women. And that's another thing about this amends process is that, you know, the times that I have been able to go face-to-face and sit down, you know, the majority of time I get to hear pieces of truth about myself. Because I was a blackout drinker. You know, it was easy for me, you know, in a general way to remember what I kind of did. But there was, like I said, I mean, no emotional connection because I wasn't really there for it. You know, but sit down years later and see the pain in their eyes to see what I did to them, you know, and it's always on God's time. You know, there are a lot of people, there are a couple people that I wanted to do immediately that wouldn't see me until years later, you know. The one that comes to mind is that, you know, I was taking this trip out in San Diego with my school, and this girl just contacted me, a girl who had been on my ASAP, who I'd written a letter to, and she never contacted me until then. And she said, I'm willing to see you. And we sat down, and at that point, it was probably 7 years later from the time that I had harmed her, and she still cried. You know, she still cried and talked about how heartbreaking it was trying to take care of me and what I did to them and how I pushed them out of my life. And she goes, she said, I could not have another good girlfriend after you. It was too hard. You know, and I'm so happy, you know, like Merv said, I mean, it's not about me. It's about giving these people some peace of mind back. And I know that my amends is not done. You know, that I may have, you know, check the box on a lot of names, but I have a lifetime worth of right living to do to correct, you know, the things that I've done out there for the people that will forever be nameless, that I have forgotten about, you know, that and the amends that I owe to the people that I did make go face to face. Because, and that's what was explained to me, is that, you know, 6 and 7 are before 8 and 9 because I need to change. You know, that I'm not spitting the same lip service and sad story about how I'm sorry, that I need to be different. You know, that I'm telling these people that I'm going out there in the world and I'm not going to harm people in the same way anymore. And that's been, you know, I mean, an uphill battle at times, you know, because I still have those same defects, you know. But every time that I want to, you know, cheat some time at work, or every time I want to put somebody down in my group and show them who's boss, you know, I remember that I told people, I made face-to-face direct amends and told them that I wasn't going to live this way anymore, you know. And, you know, I mean, I guess the one of the greatest gifts of my life today other than my sobriety, is the relationship I had with my father, you know, that those biweekly cards turned into monthly visits, you know, supervised visits, like probation, you know. And AA people would come up with me and watch me, you know, and made sure that I didn't raise my voice, made sure that I, you know, acted with principles. And eventually I was able to take that trip by myself, you know, and that one day trip turned into a one weekend trip. And, you know, within 4 years, I was able to sit down and make direct amends to my father. And today we have an unbelievable relationship. You know, and you know, so much, I thought that, you know, I was going to get sober and then everybody was going to change, would treat me different. It wasn't like that. You know, it's like I changed and my perception changed. Because all of a sudden, this man that I had demonized, you know, I would not, and I felt justified. And people told me I was justified. Therapists told me I was justified. A court would have told me I was justified. You know, but AA, you know, the people that I love and trusted here, you know, wanted more for me than I wanted for myself, because I could have easily walked away from that relationship and lived a probably normal life without a father, you know. But they pushed me, and they made me make peace there, and we were able to forgive each one another, you know. When I sat down and made direct amends to him, you know, I had no idea, you know. I had no idea how much he really did love me, how much he did pay attention to those cards. And he told me that when they ask him what's going on, he talks about me. You know, and at that time I was graduating college, and he said it's all he talks about. You know, and I had no idea. And my God, the things I would have missed. You know, my father has 3 small children a day, and I'm a part of their lives. You know, I mean, he's like one of like my best friends. You know, when something good happens, I call him. When something bad happens, I call him. You know, and there's like a mutual respect. And something that's happened even more recently in the last year is that, you know, AA and my family were always separate. You know, they didn't understand it. They didn't like it. You know, it was against their culture. I mean, you know, they just never wanted to talk about it. They kind of knew and acknowledged. I would go into meetings when I visited them, but they never wanted to talk about it. And last year, they came down. You know, they came down to my home group on New Year's Eve, you know, my father's birthday. And instead of having a party for his birthday, he spent New Year's Eve with me and my home group, because we put on a little AA play and I was in it, you know. And he fell in love with you guys, you know. And I'm so grateful that, you know, now I have one big family, you know. And my friends visit my father now. You know, people passing through New Jersey, they'll stop by my dad's house. And it's unbelievable to me. I mean, that is impossible. You know, and my dad celebrated his 60th birthday this December. And we had a party for him. And he said, I want you to give the speech. And I couldn't believe, I mean, I was talking to Valerie. I was like, Val, this is crazy. You know what I mean? I literally would have murdered him 8 years ago. You know, I would take his life. You know, and I knew I was capable of it. And here I am, you know, standing before 150 people telling you how much I love him. You know, telling you what an amazing man he is. And I know that's not me. You know, I know that's a product of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I wouldn't have wanted that. And, you know, and it's amazing, because once I made that relationship right, all of a sudden, you know, I was right with men. You know, I didn't have to, you know, dumb myself down and be like a kid and make you want to take care of me. You know, I could be an equal with a man. You know, that I got in healthier relationships in sobriety. And things have, you know, and those are amazing experiences. And I can forget, you know, I mean, Billy and I were talking about it. I mean, you asked me how I'm doing today. I'm like, good. But you let me think about it for like 5 minutes. I'm like, well, actually, you know, there's a couple things that God's not really doing right, you know. And I am, you know, there is nothing, you know, I always tell people, I mean, I've had a lot of difficulties in sobriety, and I'm not, you know, I did not walk through it with grace and dignity. You know, I was still scream crier years into sobriety. I mean, I've had my heart broken. I've been humiliated in my home group. I've had, you know, unbelievable financial problems where I didn't know how I was going to pay rent or eat. You know, I thought I was going to have to declare bankruptcy. I've lost jobs. You know, I've had deaths in the family. I mean, life happens. Life is going to show up. You know, and at first I didn't want that to happen. I just wanted to live in like sober dust and like live in like, you know, like this la-la land in the sunlight of the spirit, you know. And that's not what it's about, you know, is that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me tools. It's given me tools to live and walk through the difficult times. It's given me tools to walk through the great times and still stay here. You know, and I've watched a lot of friends leave, and I've watched a lot of women that I sponsor leave. And I hope, like what Merv was saying, that I stay in the middle. You know, that I stay teachable. I'm going to end with telling you where I've been at, is that, you know, the last 2 years have been another kind of surrender for me. You know, I mean, after, when I was like 5 years sober, I mean, all the boxes were checked. Long-term relationship, family was good, was in law school, sponsored like 20 people, you know, went to meetings 7 days a week, had an H&I committee. I mean, like, you know, on the surface, it looked like I had it going on, you know, but I wasn't, you know, because I've been experiencing these panic attacks. I began experiencing this anxiety. I began like to become like discontent. Delusion with you know, disillusion with Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I was sitting in meetings and relating out, sitting in meetings and judging whoever was talking, you know, thinking I knew what was going on. You know, I would try to 12-step or talk to people I sponsored, and it was like no heart behind it. It was all robotic, you know, all going through the motions, and I was dying on the inside, you know. And I'm so grateful that, you know, I've been in the middle enough here that when things like that happen, I have teachers. You know, I have friends and sponsors who pull me out of it. And it was funny how it happened, because we took a trip to Costa Rica, like paradise, you know. And we, you know, we're thinking we're going on this fun vacation, or I'm thinking I'm going on this fun vacation. I get there, and I had a meltdown. And they're like, why are you hysterically crying? You're in paradise, you know. And I just, you know, I got honest. And that was the thing most, you know, I love Johnny says that, you know, you know, resentment may be the number one offender, but trying to save face is number two. You know, and that's my experience, because I didn't want to talk about this. I didn't want to be honest about how I was feeling, because I thought I needed to act a certain way, you know, and be a certain person in my home group. And I got honest. And you know, what inventory revealed, you know, because I try to live in 10, 11, and 12, and I need to take a look at this stuff and what was disturbing me. And I had to take another big inventory and take a look at where I was resentful, what were my fears, how self-reliance was failing me, you know. And what was behind it is that I had so much people reliance. You know, I wanted my sponsees to fix me. I wanted my sponsor to fix me. I wanted my group to fix me. I wanted this job to fix me. And none of it, you know, that God-sized hole. And I had no God reliance. I didn't trust God. You know, I was running, Joyce was running the show again. And it's the same game that I've always been playing, that if I get my ducks in a row, if life suits, if I, you know, I arrange all these pieces right, if the set is correct, then all would be well. And it wasn't.
you know, and I mean, I experienced major turbulence after that kind of breakthrough. I mean, you know, because a lot was revealed. You know, I ended up getting Valerie, this woman, to sponsor me. Women that I sponsored for 5 years plus ended up switching sponsors. I mean, it was like a major house cleaning. You know, that 5-year relationship ended. I mean, I was forced to look at things that I was trying to evade. You know, and I was brought back to that second step. You know, is God is or He isn't? He is everything or He's nothing. What is my choice to be? You know, logic had taken me far enough. My thought process, my rationalization had took me far enough, because it makes sense after a while, right? It makes sense to live a life of service. It makes sense to carry the message. But the 12 and 12 talks about this area of two-stepping, you know, and I was dying on the inside and my spirit wasn't growing. And that's what 10, 11, 12 talk about, is that I need to grow in understanding and effectiveness. I need to seek and grow closer to that God of my understanding, because that's the whole purpose here. You know, that I am powerless and I need a greater power than me. And it's not going to be my sponsor, and it's not going to be my group, you know. And I can't hide out in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I'm grateful that in the last year, you know, I've been able to really, you know, forge this new relationship. And it's been difficult at times, but I mean, I feel, you know, more grounded here, you know, on the spiritual path than I ever have. And you know, another thing that has saved my life, you know, because throughout this turbulence and throughout other difficult periods of my sobriety, you know, I just want to talk a little bit about step 12, is that, you know, working with others, like it says in the book, I mean, has saved my life. You know, I mean, my sponsor couldn't keep me sober. You know, my group couldn't keep me sober. I've seen it. I've seen people who are seemingly busy, you know, with the fellowship leave. You know, the thing that keeps it green for me, as we would say in Jersey, is that sitting one-on-one with another alcoholic and going through this book. You know, and because by taking them through the steps, I go through the steps again. You know, by helping them identify with alcoholism, I re-identify with alcoholism. And I remember, you know, that me and this woman are the same. You know, and the other thing too is, and trying to keep my ego out of it, and knowing that it's not me. You know, that it's a God working through me. And this weekend, last night, you know, I had a great God chat. You know, we went down to these campgrounds where we have this little conference, this little camp out. And last year at this time, you know, I was working with a new girl, and we did a third step and started her on a fourth step down there. And we sat in this little, you know, secluded room reading the book. And this year, you know, I'm in charge of coffee. nice jab at the coffee makers, Merv. I was in charge of the coffee, I was carrying coffee pots. And I looked over, and that girl that I was sitting there with last year was sitting there with her sponsee, you know, taking a third step, starting her fourth step. And it was just another little God shot of how small I am in this process, you know. You know, how much bigger there is. I mean, that God really puts people in my life for a reason. You know, that my relationships here have ebbed and flowed, you know, people have come into my life. I've been introduced to people in other areas, and they all teach me, you know, I mean, and I'm so grateful, and they teach me that. And these girls, I mean, times when I didn't want to go to the meeting, times when I didn't want to pick up the new girl, you know, or I didn't want to reach my hand out, I mean, they push me because they're watching, and it's a whole nother different, you know, level of accountability, you know, and then they make me be a better AA member than I probably would be on my own. And I see miracles happen, you know. I love Merv talking about his kid, because I've gotten to watch that, you know, a girl that I sponsor got pregnant, you know, and it was one of those newcomer messes, you know, the guy left, and I was like, oh my God, what are we going to do? You know, what is she going to do? And she'd be calling me crying, and she'd be like, you know, how am I going to do this? I'd be like, don't worry, God will take care of you. You know, grace of God's all around us. You know, you just take the next right action. But deep down inside, I'm like, oh my God, what are we going to do? You know, and you know, everybody just told me, stay out of it. You know, stay out of it. You know, she has a God. And it's been amazing watching that unfold. You know, because that little boy is a part of our family. We take him to meetings. We babysit him. We take him to events, you know. And my God, the things that I would have missed. You know, and I'm so grateful that I get to participate in people's lives like that. You know, I got to be there when she had that baby. I got to be there when another woman I sponsored got married. I got to be there when my best friend's father died. I sat next to him and his father as his father took his last breath. You know, and that's not the type of person Joyce is. You know, people don't ask me to show up for stuff like that. And I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous and the life that you've given me and the person that you've made me. And I hope to continue to stay on this path. So thank you.